is an interview with Don Tippett-Smale as part of the project to document the everyday lives of the last generation of underground miners. The interview is taking place at her home in Ishpeming, Michigan, and the address is 100 Marble Street, and my name is Mary Tippett Andes. I should note, in case it sounds a little strange on the tape, that Mrs. Smale is my aunt, and so you might hear me refer to her as Auntie Don.
All right.
Let's start by having you give me your full name, including your middle name, maiden name, married name, and date of birth. My name is Don Barbara Tippett Smale, born March 20, 1924, in the Ishpeming Hospital. My twin and I, Dixie, were the only babies that my mother had in a hospital setting. And at that time, she suffered with toxemia of pregnancy, albumin poisoning, they called it then. And she nearly died. Various members of the family offered to take the babies and if she wasn't going to survive, but my father said, absolutely not, the babies will stay together. And fortunately, my mother survived. All right, can you give me your parents' full names, and if you know them, their dates of birth and their nationalities? My father was Walter Tippett, no middle initial, no middle name, born in Iron River or Iron, I can't remember, in Wisconsin, December 7, 1884.
We can check that later for me, please.
Fine. And my mother's name was Marion Edith Bengry, and she was born May 7, 1985. Right. In addition to your twin, Dixie, can you give me the names and approximate birth dates of your other siblings? My mother and father's had their first child named Vivian Sancato Tippett, and she was born in June of 15 or 16. She died of tubercular meningitis when she was 3. Their second baby was Van Stanton Tippett. He lived for 3 weeks. I don't remember his birth date right offhand, but he lived for 3 weeks and died as an infant in 1918 in the epidemic of Spanish flu during World War I. Their third child was my brother Dewey Bengry Tippett, born January 24, 1921, and then my twin and I were born in 1924, and I have an older sister by adoption named Irene Tippett. Now Irene Tippett, Laurie Vickery. She was widowed, and she was had been married to John Laurie, and then she married Bernard Vickery. She was born she had to have been born in 1914 because she's 10 years older now. Now, what were your parents' occupations? My mother was a housewife. My father worked as a policeman, a patrolman on the Market City Police Force. From there, he went to the Market Branch Prison and worked as a security guard for a short time, and then he came back to Ishpeming to work in the Barnes and Hicker mine, where his brother William was a mining captain. He offered him a job. He had gone to the North Lake Mine to ask his brother Tom for a job, but because the Barnes and Hecker property was closer at the time, he stopped to ask Uncle Billy and had a chance to go to work. Went to work on a Friday because he didn't want Granddad, my mother's father, to think that he was lazy and would not go to work right away. And that was the day that the mine had a cave-in and it was flooded and 52 men died and he was never recovered. At one time, too, he worked for the highway department and he built some steel bridges here in the UP, and I think my brother Dewey would be able to give you more details on that.
I don't think we talked about the nationality of your parents.
My father was English descent, Cornwall. There were tippets over there. Family members have gone over and looked them up. And my mother is English, Welsh, and Scotch.
Just to establish also, after your father died, your mother eventually remarried, and can you give me her second spouse's name?
I was only 2 years old when my father was killed on November 3rd, 1926. And when I was 6 years old, my mother remarried Russell Harris Hill. And his birthday was May 2nd. And he was born in 11 years older than Mama. She was 95. He had to have been born, do my calculations, Mary, 11 years before 85 would have been 74?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'd like to just basically establish what your education is and your just a bare bones work history, and then I want to get into a little more on your young adulthood
after that. I graduated from the Ishwamy High School when I had just turned 17. Dixie and I started kindergarten when we were only just over 4, which is way too early, I think. And so we graduated from Ishwamy High School in June of 41, and I worked for a while, and when my daughters were in college in the 60s, I decided that I would go back to school, and I did. I went back to Northern and finished as an LPN, and about 3-4 years later, I finished as an RN, graduating from St. Luke's School of Nursing in Marquette.
And can you give me the approximate year that you graduated as an RN, just so we can place that?
Well, I'd have to say 1972 or 3, somewhere in there.
Now let's backtrack to the time that you met your husband, and can you tell me how you met and kind of the course of your courtship and how you got married and where you got married?
Well, it's interesting. One day, Dixie and I and a friend were bicycling down to Ishwamy because we live in the township, which is about a mile out of the city limits. And this car pulled up alongside of us with some young fellows, and they struck up a conversation with my twin. And she immediately thought the driver was pretty cute because he had curly hair and blue eyes and a big line of blarney. So he was 19 years old and from Negaunee. So he would come up to date Dixie, and my mother wouldn't allow her to be alone with him unless I was along. I had to chaperone. And if you think going on a date is fun, try chaperoning your twin and having to sit in the back seat of a car with any number of different guys that he brought out to keep me entertained while he courted my sister. But we were, as I say, we were only 16 and still seniors in high school, and so she wasn't allowed to go with him. If she went to a movie, she could be alone with him. Otherwise, I had to chaperone. Very fun time. So one day, Dixie said to me, Hugh has a cute younger brother. He's got long legs, and he's cute. And I said, well, bring him up, and I'll look him over. So Hugh came out the next time and brought his kid brother with him. And I looked him over, and I wasn't too impressed because I didn't really care for boys anyway. I'd rather read. But I had to go out with Dixie anyway, and so I'd sometimes go out with a book, my hair in pin curls, and Lowell sat on the other side of the back seat and looked out the window because I wasn't interested, but he had to be there because I had to be there. But one night in the fall, and Dixie and Hugh had met in the spring, we were down at a camp near Gwynn where his sister and husband lived. Abe Wolf was married to Lowell's sister for a while, and it was evening and sunset, and Lowell was in the CCCs in a uniform, and there's nothing cuter than a man in a uniform. And as he stood by the lake, all of a sudden he just looked cute as all get out, and I thought, well, say, that's kind of nice. I kind of like him. So then at Christmas time, when the boys were up, they wanted to give us gifts, and I didn't want a gift, but they brought out handbags and gloves for each of us. Now, Hugh had a job, so I'm sure he paid for it, because Lowell didn't have a job. He was only, let's see, I was 17, and Lowell was 18, and he was working part-time, so he didn't have the extra money. But he gave me the purse and the gloves. And then as we were standing in my mother's front hall and it was time for him to leave, he wanted to give me a kiss. And I didn't want to kiss him. I hadn't kissed him up to that time, but I'd been going out with him all summer. But I thought, gee, I owe him something. So I let him kiss me. And it really wasn't anything spectacular. No stars, no pinwheels. But that was my first kiss from my husband, see. Years later, when he came back from overseas and he'd been gone for 2.5 years and I hadn't seen him, we've been making up and doing an awful lot of kissing in the last 40 years. We're not caught up yet.
Can you tell me where you got married and what was happening just briefly in your life at that time?
Well, my mother didn't liked the idea that I was going with Lowell. She thought we were too young, and he didn't have a steady job, and we were too young, really. But Uncle Percy Bengry had come up from Lansing on vacation, and so my mother had talked to him and said, you know, how it would be all right if Don went down to Lansing and stayed with you and got a job, and this way she thought, I'll split this romance. So she was a little surprised that I was so willing to go along with it. What she didn't know was that Lowell already had a job at the Ypsilanti Willow Run Bomber Plant, and Ypsi's not too far from Lansing. So she kind of played into our hands, and I saw Lowell a few times while we were down in Ypsi and Lansing. But one day I had a telegram from my mother, or a phone call from my mother, saying that my brother Dewey's ship had landed, and it was wartime, and he was in a lot of action. He was on the USS Boise. So we decided that we would be coming home. I was going to come home, but we planned on getting married. And had set up the date at the Episcopal Chapel, but when I heard from my mother that my brother was coming home, I said, I'm not getting married. I'm going home. My brother's coming home. Lowell said, you can't go home because we're going to get married. And I said, no, I am going home. I'm seeing my brother. And so we changed our plans and went to the Methodist parsonage. And the minister married us at 10:30 in the morning. He was in a smoking jacket and slippers. And his housekeeper and his wife were our attendants. And we were married and then headed for home. And it was November 25, 1942. The weather was terrible. I think it was the day before Thanksgiving. And by the time we got up to the streets of St. Ignace, it was stormy and it was so cold. And we had to take a hotel room. And we slept in our clothes. I slept in my snowsuit because it was bitterly cold in there. So all we did was hold hands and kiss on the night we were married. But we made up for that since, too. Then we headed for home the next day, got as far as Negaunee. What happened to your car, Lowell? Look, we couldn't come any farther, so we called here. Hugh was home in Negaunee, and he gave us a ride back up here, and he said, you crazy fools, what are you doing out in weather like this? I left Ishpeming and missed out on the Thanksgiving dinner because the weather was so bad, and you're driving in from downstate. So we came back up. We were married a month before we told our parents that we were married, and my mother was angry with me because one night Lowell came up to see me, and I was sitting on one end of the couch, and he laid on it with his head in my lap, and it was 10:30 at night, which was her idea of curfew, and she said, it's time you went to bed, and I said, yes, and she saw him laying there with his head in my lap, and she said, is that any way for a decent girl to behave? And off she stormed upstairs, and we decided we'd have to tell our parents. So the next day was Sunday morning, and my mother was baking pies, and she's still angry with me because I wasn't behaving like a lady. And she said, if you're going to behave that way, I think the best thing for you to do is be married. And I said, I am. And she and when did this all happen? And I said, last month. And she said, well, why didn't you come home to get married? And I said, because you'd stop us. She said, yes, you were right. I would have. And it's lasted 51 years.
All right. What I'd like to do is fast forward a little bit to the time that Lowell started working at the mine. And I'd like to kind of get a feeling for what kind of place you lived in and whether you had children then. Just give me a little rough sketch of what life was like at that point.
After Lowell came home from overseas, we had an apartment on the street over from where we live now. And he had worked in the woods for a jobber until he could get into the mine. But I had no qualms about him going into the mine or going underground. After all, we had a mining family history. All the extended family were miners and worked. The mines gave you steady work. They gave you the best pay of any of the employers, the best coverage for medical benefits and all. So when he had a chance to go underground or work for the mines, we were all just pleased because it meant a good income and steady income. I listened to so much talk about underground mining and the various terminology that they used. I had no reason to be worried about it. Even though my father had been killed, we all understood that that was a cave-in due to hitting an underground body of water. But that was 20 some years before Lowell went into and the technology had made us feel that it was a safe place to be. What was the rest of your question?
I wanted to get a feeling for what your lifestyle, I guess, would have been like at that time.
Well, we lived from paycheck to paycheck, really, because we were just starting off. We had no savings. When Lowell was discharged from the service, we had what was called a 52-20. 52 weeks of $20 a week was what the veterans were given. And so we lived with that, and then the monies that he earned, and we literally lived from payday to payday, making do with the bare minimums in our apartment. We had a bedroom set, we had a kitchen set, we had a stove, we had an ice box because after the war there were no appliances that were so in stock that we had to wait. We had our name on a waiting list for a refrigerator, and until then we got an ice box. Later on we could even buy the motor and the freezing unit to go into the ice box, and converted that into a refrigerator.
Can you describe what the ice box, how the ice box worked?
We had to buy ice, and there was still an ice house in Ishpeming where because there were still enough ice boxes. The ice box was like a refrigerator, but on the top was a compartment where you put in the block of ice, and that just kept your food cool. The water drained down a pipe down into a drainage tray on the bottom, and then you emptied that and watched out for it. And that's what we had to keep our food cool. We didn't think that it was a hardship. We were just glad that we were able to get that to keep food fresh.
And can you tell me what the ice box was made out of and how frequently you would have to change the ice?
It looked like a refrigerator today. The old ones used to be made out of oak and wood and had a metal box that would hold the ice. The ice would last us maybe every 3 or 4 days, then we'd have to buy a new block of ice, but ice was cheap. I don't recall how much it cost. But that was okay.
Do you recall, at the time that Lowell first started working in the mine, approximately what his take-home pay would have been and how frequently payday was?
Payday, as I remember, was every 2 weeks. And I don't remember what we made. Lowell, what did you make?
What?
What did you earn when you first worked at the mine? Payday was every 2 weeks.
Two something. $2.45 an hour.
For an 8-hour day?
Yeah.
Well, $20 a day then.
Yeah.
About $20 a day.
$2.45 an hour for an 8-hour day is what he said. Okay.
Right. Right. And then we would have to go down to what we call the big office to pick up the checks. They weren't mailed to you. You had to pick up your own checks, and those of us who were well-known enough or known at the office, the wives could go and pick up the men's checks. Otherwise, the men had to pick up their own checks.
And where was the big office?
The big office was downtown here in Ishpeming, on the corner of Euclid and I don't know, Spruce? No, couldn't have been Spruce. Euclid and Barnum, I think. It's the building is there today. It has other uses.
And who handled the money in the household? Was it you or was it Lowell?
Well, it was kind of a joint thing, but I paid all the bills. It got so that I picked up his check and I signed the check, and we had a joke about his signature being invalid anymore. But it was a joint thing. I could handle the money, and I could account for the money, but we budgeted right down to meter money and stamps, postage stamps. And I had a ledger, and sometimes we broke the rules and splurged a little, Dixie and I. If we happened to buy something on a sale, we managed to hang it in the closet until one day when we took it out, our husbands would say, "Well, when did you get that?" And we'd say, "Oh, it's been in the closet a while," but we didn't tell them that it was brand new. They weren't really fooled.
What kinds of things, this is before your children were born, what kinds of things would you consider, other than a little clothing item, to have been a real splurge?
When our children were born, Roxy was born a year after Lowell got back from the China-Burma-India Theater. And right after he had his job, he got his job at the mine, he decided to build. And from then on, we were budgeted so tightly that the only splurge that I can ever say we went to is a couple times we went to a carnival. And that's when I learned never to gamble again, because we gambled on some of these stupid win a plush toy things. And, of course, the game was rigged, and we lost $9. And that was painful. So we didn't play those games anymore, and we haven't gambled since. I don't even buy lottery tickets. But we didn't splurge a whole lot. We never went on vacations. It was always something to do for the house, always a bill at the lumberyard. After the kids were home, kids were born, then it was glasses, shoes, dentists.
I suppose I should backtrack a little bit, too. I'm unclear. I need to have y'all line for me names and birth dates of the kids and when they were born relative to Uncle Lowell starting work at the mine. Were the kids, did you already have one of the kids before he started at the mine, or, you know, how did that fit together?
Lowell came home in April of 1940. He came home in April 46. And Roxy was born in May 3rd, 1947. Melody was born, that's Roxy Dawn Smale was born May 3rd, 1947. Melody Lois Smale was born in July 16, 1949. We were living in an apartment when Roxy was born. Lowell gave me a dozen roses the day that the baby was born. He was still working in the woods cutting pulp. We couldn't afford a dozen roses, but let me tell you, I was thrilled to have them. And then we began to build our house, and my mother had given us each a lot to build homes on, and that was money that was from our father, Walter Tippett's death, when the company had given them some kind of settlement. She wanted us to have something from our father, so we each had a lot to build on. And I remember being PG and helping Lowell put tar paper on the subflooring to close in the basement, and I could hardly bend over my belly because I was PG and having Melody. But we were in the house before Melody was born, and we lived on subflooring and cheap linoleum and... it was all part of the game. If he didn't have the money, we were lucky he had the ambition to do it. Because by the time Melody was born, Lowell was working at the CCI, and we had a steady income. We would order what we needed from the lumberyard for the next phase, and after that was paid off, then we would order some more. And so we had kind of had a running bill, but it was always paid up before we went on to the next phase. Eventually, we had to go to the bank and borrow $3,000, which we thought was the national debt, but that really helped us finish off the house to a little more to our satisfaction. And then over the years, we've just worked at it and remodeled it and taken care of it. But always, we were budgeted, always.
This is side two of tape number one of our interview with Dawn Smale on April 14th, 1994 at her home in Ishpeming, Michigan. We just talked about mortgage, and I take it that you've lived in the same house. This is the only home that you've lived in?
This is the only home that Laurel and I have lived in and since we've been married. And other than the summer home we have out at the lake.
We'll talk about that in a little bit, but let me just establish approximately what the size of your house is. And is your house typical of other people who are mining families that you're aware of?
I think our home is pretty typical. It's not very big. I think we're 35 by 28, Lowell. Dimensions of your house, 25 by 38? We added a porch onto it at one time and decided to enclose that completely and convert that into an additional room. But we do have, and originally our attic space had to be converted then into living space because in 1955 we adopted Michael Keith Smale, and we needed a bedroom just for him to comply with the courts, and so the girls then moved upstairs, and each had an end of the attic space. We put in carpeting and flooring and made it livable. So that ultimately we wound up with three bedrooms downstairs and two bedrooms upstairs and a bathroom, a living dining area, kitchen area, and then our front porch became our fireside room. Full basement, outdoor garage, and nice yard.
Do most houses in this area have basements?
Yes. I don't know of anybody who doesn't have a basement.
Okay. Does the basement under the house have, or does the climate in the area have a lot to do with why there's a basement under the house, do you think?
I suppose so. Every house that I ever knew of had a basement. My mother's home had a basement with the foundation, and the walls were of stone put together with mortar, and I remember half the basement being sand floor, which at one time was used for storing garden vegetables. The beets and potatoes and carrots and things were put in the sand and buried and preserved that way. We had a coal bin in this house because we had a wood coal furnace to start off with. It was cheaper. Lowell felt that in later years we converted to oil, but initially we didn't have the money to go into an oil furnace, so we started off with wood and coal. And of course, down in the basement are my washer and my dryer now. Should have had a dryer when the children were little, but we didn't have the money. Now, once the kids were grown and bigger, and there were no diapers and no wash and wear fabrics, why, I have all the conveniences that I could have used then.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that a little bit more. That's a question I wanted to ask you anyway. What can you think of other kinds of conveniences other than your dryer that you have now that you didn't have then, or that weren't available then, or that weren't affordable? And I'm talking then being maybe the 50s, which is about the time that the kids were in grade school and just growing up.
Well, now we have a freezer, and we could stock a whole lot more foods. That would have been nice. We have today television and VCR and the other microwave and all that of course we didn't have then. But
okay, let me ask you another question. You would have had a radio and probably like a record player maybe when the kids were smaller. Do you remember approximately when it was that you acquired a television set, and what kinds of things did the kids do for recreation or entertainment when they were growing up? What were the typical kinds of games or things that they enjoyed, or the kinds of activities that they enjoyed?
Well, it must have been, 40 years ago before we had TV, maybe even less than that, because Dixie and Hugh had a television. We used to go up there and watch it, even watching the snow. But at least the sound came through. But oh, we thought that was great. But we couldn't afford one. We had three children, and with each one of them, two of them wearing glasses, all three in corrective shoes, we couldn't afford them. We did have radios. The kids had their own little record players for music because they enjoyed music. And we played a lot of games. Every Christmas, Santa Claus brought games. And what I did with our kids was put the toys that they played the most with, I left out at Christmas time. And those that they didn't seem too interested in, we would put away. And of course, parents buy what they would like as well. So, excuse me. So then we would put them away. And then, along about January, February, March, April, when sickness struck, then when the kids were sick and in bed, I would take out one of their Christmas games, and it looked new to them, and it was new to them, and then we'd play, and we'd retire them for a while, and we kind of rotated things, but the kids always had games and music
and books,
always books.
Do you remember specifically what any of the games were, or what particular types of books they liked, or what records, what songs they liked a lot that would have been popular at that time?
They were mostly the children's songs, the golden books we read. They liked the children's records that were Golden put out. It wasn't so much popular music as it were the little ditties that the kids could play they played Monopoly. They played, what was that game? Candyland? Oh, Melody loved Candyland. She nearly wore it out. And Michael always played with his trucks. Roxy always had to have boy things more than girl things. She always wanted to be an Apache warrior or Prince Valiant. So there were always swords and bows and arrows and horses and figurines, and Melody liked always having dolls, so that was her happiness, with dolls and dishes, and Michael always liked his trucks. They had bicycles. They had card games that they liked to play.
What about during the winter time? What were the activities that the kids liked in the winter time?
Well, in the winter, they just liked being out in the snow. Sledding. Didn't do too well on skis, although I did when I was growing up. We played with skis. And they never skated a whole lot because they were in corrective shoes. Building forts, and sledding, tobogganing, sliding down the Tippett's terraces, and tobogganing. Sometimes we would go to the winter sports area here in Ishpeming and toboggan, and that was always a fun thing, going down on that chute.
Winter sports area being the Alqual Recreation Area?
Alqual Recreational Area.
Mm-hmm. Now, the clothing that kids wore to play outdoors at that time was somewhat different than it is now. Can you describe what kind of winter clothing the kids would wear and what the routine was when they would go out to play?
Well, when they were little, it was always dressing them in snow pants, heavy lined quilted pants made of woolen, or if it was poplin, at least they were lined with quilted fabric to keep them extra warm. Socks, boots, shoes went into overshoes or galoshes or overshoes. And
what were the overshoes made of?
Rubber. And then they wore mittens.
How many pairs of mittens?
Usually one pair of mittens and with strings on them and run through the sleeves and around the neck so that they wouldn't lose them. Good warm jacket or coat, scarves, woolen knitted woolen helmets or warm hats. And when the weather was real cold, we wrapped their mufflers around their noses and mouths so that they could stay out in the air. And invariably, when you'd get your little one out, and they wouldn't be out for 2 minutes before they had to come in and go to the bathroom, so they had to go through the whole procedure of taking it all off, going to the bathroom, putting it all back on, and then the next one had to come in. So it got to be a little tedious until they got a little older and could manage. But they loved being outdoors and making snow angels in the snow, lay on your back and fan your arms and make an angel figure in the snow, and forts. But they were dressed warmly, and it's different today because the young people seem to run around in their Adidas and bare legs. Some of the girls go to school in short skirts and bare legs and dress slippers, and I can't see how they can tolerate it, but they do.
Can you remember approximately what children's clothing would have cost, what the cost of a typical week's trip to the grocery store would have been when the kids were growing up in the 50s?
Cost of groceries. We charged some of our groceries at a neighborhood store, the Cullis's Market, and then we switched to another local neighborhood store, Lindquist Market, and eventually we decided that but you see, you can buy an awful lot of things. It's like charge cards today. If you aren't careful, before you knew it, your credit slip was more than really you could handle, and the grocers would be kind enough to say, all right, you can pay so much on your bill, and they would accept your credit. But we wanted to get away from that, and it was in the early 50s that we converted into going strictly cash at one of the supermarkets downtown. What was the other part of your question?
Approximate cost of weekly cost of groceries, and then if there's a typical clothing item that you can remember that you would have had to purchase a lot, what would you have? Could you give me some kind of an idea? Maybe like the cost of undershirts or something like that.
I think that we spend about $20-$25 a week on groceries. Clothing, undershirts, under a dollar. But I did a lot of sewing. There were certain garments that I would buy for the family, panties, bras, slips, socks, Lowell's underwear. But when it came to other items of clothing, I sewed, and I made them all. I even made Lowell a suit one year, and and took a great sense of pride in sewing, because my mother had sewed for us, and it was not only cheaper, but it gave you a sense of being creative and productive, and I still sew. Now, any idea what the price per yard, say for 100% cotton or a typical fabric you might use to make a dress or a shirt or something like that? And do you have any idea how the cost compared with what a ready-to-wear item of similar, a similar type of ready-to-wear item would cost?
Well, we were always accustomed to buying fabrics, and it seemed to me that if we got cotton and percales and all for just under a dollar or just a little over a dollar, that was really all that you should have to pay for them. And it astonishes me now to go down and find that I can't buy fabric comparably for less than maybe $4 a yard, unless it's on sale. And but when you make your own things, you can save it might have to sell for maybe 2 and 3 times what you paid for it, if not more, depending, I suppose, on the kind of work you did. If you did inferior kinds of construction, then it wouldn't cost very much. Today I have a sewing machine that'll do fancy stitches, and a serger that'll do edging and everything else that would have been ideal then. But I made slip covers, I made curtains, I made draperies, bedspreads, and clothing items, and I felt that was what we had to do to make ends meet, because we only had Lowell's salary to live on.
In your circle of family and acquaintances, was it real typical for the women to do a lot of sewing and things like that to stretch money?
Yes. On my sister and I, my brother and his wife, we all lived within our incomes. We never did go into stores and buy ready-made clothing. Coats, I think we did. But not coats even for the children. We made our children snowsuits and coats. But around here, yeah, there were a few people that I knew whose husbands worked in the mines who went to the style shop and bought clothing. But all I can think is that they must have lived on credit, because we were pay-as-you-go. And my husband's philosophy was, if you can't pay cash for it, then you can't afford it. It killed him to even have to charge lumber at the lumberyard. So the only things we ever charged were groceries for a few years, and then charging supplies at the lumberyard. But beyond that, if we couldn't pay cash for it, we couldn't afford it.
Was there a lot of clothing handed down among your family or among your extended family, and was that a big part of it?
Yes. And it was kind of a fun thing, because the Tippett girls were living next door. And when I would have some pretty dresses, they were Kate Greenaway dresses. And every Kate Greenaway dress had a pocket. Now, they had been given to me by a woman who could afford to buy these kinds of named things. And so when Roxy finished, then they went up to Tippett's. And when Trina was finished, they came back. And when Melody was finished, they went back to Tippett's, and they were never ever worn out, because when you had a good dress or Sunday dresses or Sunday clothes and school clothes, you took care of them. And when the children came home, they immediately changed into either little dungarees or slacks that we made for them, and little blouses and shirts, and you had play clothes and you had good clothes. And we stretched, and they would go back and forth and back and forth. And finally, I remember giving all these things away to another woman whose children needed things. And they went on and on. But we swapped all the time. We didn't ever swap shoes. Nobody ever wore someone else's shoes.
Can you describe what a what the outfit types of things would be if there was a like for church or for Christmas or something like that? What would a special item of clothing or a special outfit consist of?
Well, say Easter, because that was always something we waited for. It meant new shoes, new anklets. Unless it was cold, then the girls wore their long white stockings. They always wore little harnesses that we made for them, or we call them garter belts, and they were little, like a camisole, and we could fasten the garters to the bottom of that little camisole, and then the garters, of course, reached to the top of their stockings, kept them up nice and snug so they didn't bag at the knees, and then they wore a pretty dress, and I would make the dresses, and some of them, I remember one year making them out of a kind of a seersucker organdy in tiers, with white lace around the little puff sleeves and white lace around the necklines and a sash, and oh, the girls thought they were great. And then they wore white gloves and carried little purses to church. Always wore little white hats with turned up brims and flowers, and off we marched to church. And if it were Christmas, it would be another outfit for Christmas, but fabrics that were warmer than Easter. And we took care of our clothing, and they wore them until they grew out of them, which maybe they could get two seasons.
Let's talk about church a little bit. Did you attend church regularly, and if so, what church was it?
Laura was raised a Methodist, and when we were married in the Methodist parsonage because, as I say, we headed for home when Dewey's ship had docked. But I had grown up in the Episcopal Church in Ishpeming, the Grace Episcopal Church, and was baptized there. And grew up there, sang in the choir, and then when my children were born, they were baptized there, and baptized by the same priest who had baptized me, which made it rather a neat experience. And then we attended church regularly, and we still do. God is important in our lives. We feel blessed, and we thank Him for our blessings. I'm an active person in the church. I'm as a Eucharistic minister, a lay person, a lay reader. Been on the vestry. Lowell has been on the vestry. He still spends a lot of time at the church doing whatever might need to be done in as far as maintenance and that kind of thing.
Did most of the people that you associated with, family and friends and so forth, belong to a church? Was that a pretty essential part of life?
Yes. My brother and his family were and are Lutherans because it was always important to them. My sister and her husband attend Grace Episcopal Church, the same as we do. Most of our friends had church affiliations. Some were not... didn't attend church regularly, although they attended church on Christmas and Easter and that kind of thing. But yes, most of us had church ties.
Let's get into the neighborhood a little bit. In some parts of the country, people lived in row houses in cities or on farms. The nearest neighbor might have been 2 or 3 miles away. Can you give me a little picture of the neighborhood that you've lived in your entire married life, like how big it is, how many houses it is, how well the neighbors knew each other, how long many of the neighbors would have lived here, were there a lot of people in and out? Was there pretty much a steady population of the same people that you would get to know over the years? Just paint me a little picture.
When we built our homes after when the war was over, There were many of the GIs who came back who wanted to locate in the area and who built homes in this little plat of West Ishpeming. This is the original plat of West Ishpeming. And the school was just, you know, we're like two blocks deep and five blocks long. And the school was in the center. And so our children just had to walk up the street to the top of the hill, and there in the next blocks was the school.
I want to stop on the school for a second. How large was the school, and how many grades would the school accommodate, and did it have an auditorium or a gym, or how many floors was it? Can you give me a little rough description of what you recall of the school?
Well, this school was built, it's a brick building, it was built in 1916. It had, in the basement level, a gym. It had another room that was a wood shop, workshop for the boys, and it had a furnace room and restrooms. And then on the main floor, there was a classroom to the right as you entered, and there was a classroom to the right, and I think that was first and second grades. And in the auditorium, they had a kindergarten class. In the room to the left across the hall were grades, I believe, 7 and 8. That's when I was there. I think when my children were going there, it was up to grade 5 and 6. Five? And as you entered the school, there was the entry and two stairways going down to the basement, one on the right and one on the left. And then there were these two classrooms and the auditorium. And then you went up a wide staircase to the second level. And there was a classroom on the right and left there and restrooms. And I can't tell you which grades would have been in those classes. But there was also a small room up there that was the principal's office, and we were impressed with that because I had been sent there a few times in my day.
I won't ask what for. School routine a little bit. The school is close enough that the kids could walk to school. Did they come home for lunch?
They came home for lunch every day and would climb the hill and go to school and then come home for lunch. They had 1 hour, and they would come home and have sandwiches and or a bowl of soup, and they always wore the little aprons that I had made for them. And even when Michael came to live with us, he just loved having his own aprons and putting on his apron, and we always made his apron look like a boy's apron and not a girl's apron. And then they were, when they came home from school, then they changed their clothing and went out to play, and their good clothes were put away in the school, and they were in play clothes.
Was it very typical in a small neighborhood this size to have a school, a local school that the kids could walk to?
Yes, it was then, because there was a school in North Lake that had a school for the lower grades, and ultimately Our students right here from West Ishpeming went to North Lake School for grades 7 and 8. And they were bused. They were picked up by a bus at the school entrance, and off they went. Speaking of coming home for lunch and all, I remember when Melody brought home some little girls that lived out by the gold mine, and she said, "I don't like that little girl," and she named her. And I said, "Why don't you like her?" And I thought she was going to say, because she's dirty or her hair is matted, but she didn't. She said, "Oh, I don't like her because she looked at my paper." But these were little girls that lived in a terrible windowless building out near the gold mine with rags stuffed in the windows, and they slept in old coats and sometimes came and cast off clothing so that it was so ragged and torn. And sometimes she would bring them home for lunch, and I would feed them. And I remember buying them each a jump rope for 10 cents at the store, because Melody had a new jump rope. And the teachers then called and asked me if I had given them these jump ropes because they wanted to be sure that they hadn't gone to the store and stolen them. Eventually, those children were taken away from the parents and put into some kind of custody because they were not fed properly.